secret societies and esoteric organizations of the world have passed through three distinct stages with the lapse of ages. Nearly all of the great mystical schools of antiquity were essentially philosophical. That is, they approached life with the search for a better and deeper understanding of the operations of universal law. These old schools, being the repositories of the first sciences of mankind, were dominated by certain concepts of exactitude. They were religious, but their religions were very deeply philosophical and rather amazingly scientific. In their philosophy, they sought to understand, in order that they could apply that which they understood to the immediate conduct of their lives. And in times when these mysteries dominated the world systems of policy, they were also devised for the purpose of contributing to the collective security of society. In those days, most of these philosophic systems were actually applied to the regulation of states and nations. And such record as we have would indicate that where this occurred, there was a marked improvement in the life of the people. Gradually, however, these ancient institutions moved from a philosophic foundation to a theological foundation. Philosophy remained. Science, to a measure, also remained. But emphasis was primarily upon the devotional aspects of religion. Out of this great cycle came most of the mystical movements which have survived to the present time. The philosopher finally came to the realization that intellectualism, no matter how idealistic it might be, led ultimately to a kind of mental stalemate. The mind, having exhausted its own potentials, was still faced with the mystery of an unsolved universe. As one scholar has pointed out, when we seek to solve the mystery of the universe, we must remember that man himself is part of this mystery and part of this universe, and that we cannot hope to solve the world mystery without solving the man mystery. This is the most difficult task which the human being ever attempted. Religion, in a way, appeared to circumvent some of these difficulties, for it held an attitude of direct devotion, the possibility of the individual experiencing in his own heart the realities of things which could not be estimated by the mind, so that beyond reason there were certain basic acceptances, and on these acceptances the good life had to be built. As Plato has told us, all learning, therefore, led finally to an enlightened believing. And the individual, having carried his quest as far as he could, and standing in the midst of a universe which he knew to be a rational entity, could then be satisfied without exploring the most remote aspects of this rational entity. He could accept He could assume, therefore, that at the root of life was goodness, wisdom, truth, light, strength, and love. By such believing, he found his way into a more sensitive and at the same time a more simple and direct communion with the mysteries around him and within him. Thus we had the coming of many largely mystical organizations, of which such as the Sufis, the Dervishes, and a number of the mystical sects of China and Japan are examples. The third stage in the development of secret societies and esoteric groups was largely political. In the course of time, there was a gradual corruption, so obvious in the management of states, that it became increasingly imperative that some organization of well-minded and well-intentioned persons should arise to combat the corruption which threatened the survival of human society. Secret organizations, by their very natures, provided opportunities for the gathering of minds, for the weighing of social and political problems, for the expression of discontents, and even, we may say, the breeding of revolutions. This phase of the secret society more or less died out when it seemed that mankind was well on the way to an ordered international relationship. But as our international relationships have gradually deteriorated, and as the problems of administration have again been heavily burdened with corruption, the tendency of secret organizations has been to revive, as in the case of the Hung Association in China, to again liberate man from the despotism of conditions over which the average disorganized person has little, if any, influence. Thus we can trace the descent of attitudes and the various uses that can be made of private assembly, and how these uses can affect the human being in a number of different ways. With these thoughts in mind, we must now go back to the first age which we have considered, the time in which these secret organizations were essentially philosophical. We have already considered a number of these organizations, as those of Egypt and Greece, and among the primitive inhabitants of the Western Hemisphere. Now we have to turn our attention to the great expanse of Transasia, fully aware that while we have become overly attentive to the development of European and Mediterranean cultures, we have been less thoughtful of that larger part of the world, which is Asia, and which from the most remote time has also made a powerful contribution to the general progress of humankind. We are not certain at this date as to when and where those great institutions, which were to become the glory of Asia, first came into existence. But we are inclined to assume that their genesis was similar to that in other regions, that these mysteries began as with primitive people in the fertility rites, in the various seasonal festivals, and again in that most important of all ceremonies, the ceremony of initiation into citizenship in the tribe. We know that India, long before the rise of the great Aryan migrations, was populated with a people we now call the Dravidians. We know not too much of the beginnings of these people, nor are we able to estimate too perfectly their cultural level, but we are inclined to assume that it was barbaric, or at least that it belonged in an aboriginal group, perhaps not so dissimilar from the various tribal religious structures in the world today. At last, from the northern parts of the great band of the Himavat, which we call the mountains, the Himalayas, there descended a series of migrations across what is called the great Gangetic Plain of India. Migrations from the north, which by degrees overwhelmed the original inhabitants and established on this continent the great social institution of the Aryas. The word Arya means the noble, or, as some affirm, the anointed, the set apart, that which has some strange or mysterious destiny in itself. But I think that this would be considered purely a local meaning, not too different from the name Eskimo, for example, which also means a chosen people. We have never been over-influenced by the Eskimos' bid for world domination, nor will we probably be wrong in assuming that nearly every nation regarded itself as the peculiar child of an inevitable destiny, and upon this built the strong processes of its bid for world power. In any event, among these ancient Aryan forebears of the modern Hindus, there were set up certain great rules and regulations of conduct. These enriched and became more complicated and involved in the course of time, and the principal rules and laws which influenced this early people are preserved for us in the Rig Veda and the Institutes of Manu. From these books, we learn that the life of the ancient Aryan Hindu was very largely a ceremonial life. The primitive divisions of the caste system appointed certain distinct and inevitable labors. Each group had its tasks appointed. And most of all, it was important to these people that their blood should not be diluted by alliance with the Dravidian forebears. Therefore, rules governing intermarriage and marriage outside of the clan are strongly noted in the ancient Vedic writings. In time, however, as the cultivation of arts and sciences, philosophies, and religious conviction enriched our ancient Aryan forebears, they gradually developed in this mysterious and remote land one of the highest and most abstract cultures the world has ever known. Discussing this problem many years ago with a prominent Hindu, he pointed out that 5,000 years ago, the literacy rate in India was higher than it is in America today. In the interval, however, there has been the inevitable decline of peoples, which is for a large part the account of history. We know that in the ancient Indic lands, scientists, philosophers, scholars, poets, musicians, and artists came to great skill that architecture was cultivated with rare understanding and insight, that many secrets of nature still unknown to us were explored and researched. And out of this entire pageantry of gradually intensifying endeavor, there rose finally the great Brahmanical colleges, which for a long time were the greatest depositories of knowledge of which we have any record. I think we may safely assume that the Brahmanic universities were, like the Egyptian schools, partly devoted to the advancements of science and partly devoted to the unfoldment of the latent potentials within the consciousness of the human being. Asia, from the beginning, was dominantly introversional. The Asiatic sought to explore not the furthermost parts of space, but the innermost parts of self. This has been the direction of his thinking for thousands of years, and it is only under the immediate impact of present world conditions that we find him extroverting rather frenziedly and without adequate rationalization, largely as the result of the impact of our way of life upon the more remote regions of the earth. We may therefore assume, I believe, that the rites of India, the great Brahmanic schools, taught a kind of complete knowledge. That this knowledge, because Hinduism was not only a religion, but a national and a racial religion, and those not of the race were thereby excluded from participation in its advantages, that ancient Hinduism consisted of one general system of culture which involved all the people in varying degrees, and that the life of the Hindu, whether within the temple or within the privacy of his own home, was under one broad pattern of discipline. From the record of Pythagoras of Samos, who visited India in the 6th century before the beginning of the Christian era, and was initiated into the Brahmanical rites at Elephanta and Ellora, according to his report, these rituals were identical in meaning, identical in essence, with the initiatory rites of Persia, Egypt, and Greece, in which he had already been duly initiated. He therefore tells us that all the mystery systems of the world, European and Asiatic and North African, had the same essential doctrine, namely the unity of God, the brotherhood of man, and an exact science for the unfoldment and regeneration of human beings. These were the departments and areas of general coverage. We have particular respect for the opinion of Pythagoras in this matter, for the reason that, so far as we know, he is the only non-Hindu who was ever initiated into the secret rituals of the ancient Brahmins. Others have claimed this, and I have examined and considered a number of reports claiming to be expositions or exposés of the religious mysteries of the Hindus. And I am convinced that these reports are the productions of imagination or imposture, and that so far as is generally known, Pythagoras and possibly Apollonius of Tyana are the only ones who have a valid claim to having actually participated in the inner rites of the Hindu sanctuaries. In any event, we know very little about these rites. But as we may judge to a measure the root of a tree by the tree itself, its branches, and its fruit, so we may gain some insight as to the original teachings of the Hindus by consideration of the results of these teachings as they spread out across India and later into other parts of Asia, and how through their reforms and reorganizations they became the principal vitalizing agents behind a variety of cultural achievements. Also from the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Puranas, the Bharatas, and other commentaries, we can come to a reasonable understanding of the inner life of these people, of that which was valuable and meaningful to them, of the ceremonies which were essentially required of them, their way of life, and the effect of their religion upon their immediate personal conduct. From all of these sources and by all of these observations, I think we must finally come to the conclusion that Brahmanism was a valid system of instruction, that it was taught by degrees only, that the neophytes or candidates were advanced according to their merits, and were finally entrusted with the most important knowledge possessed by that time and by that people, and that this knowledge definitely had as its heart and soul a secret science of human regeneration. That it was a science dealing with the inner life of man, the relationship between man and nature, and also the relationship between man and God. That the so-called scientific part of this training was dependent upon its religious part, and that what we call its religious part today was both scientific and philosophic, and that these people advanced such sciences as geometry, mathematics, astronomy, and music to a very advanced degree. This does not enable us to revive the details of the ancient form of Brahmanic worship. And I would seriously doubt if this could be revived even by the average Hindu of today. These belong to times far back. And since those times, there have been changes and revolutions of ideas in Asia as in other parts of the world. By degrees, the Brahmanic mysteries fell into the Brahmanic theology. And in turn, this has ultimately led to a certain Brahmanic sociology, even a Brahmanic political science. But for our purposes, I believe that we must accept that at a very ancient time, the rites of the Hindus, paralleling those of other enlightened nations, were dedicated to the most noble and constructive of purposes, and sought to create in society a valuable and integrated human being. Now we know that this declined. We know that it declined in Greece, and that the great Dionysian rituals of the Greeks are finally remembered to us only by the Bacchanalian orgies of Rome. We know that in many respects, religions and philosophies have lost their essential value and have by degrees fallen into ill repute. At the same time, out of these ancient Indian schools came a series of reforms, and these reforms were in truth merely specializations, efforts on the part of enlightened and conscientious persons to restore the integrity and ethics of great systems that had come into decline. We like to sometimes consider Christianity to be a largely a reformed Judaism, in which, as the Master himself says, He came not to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill the law and the prophets. And I think in India also, the great schools, such as the Vedanta, or the Yoga, the Tantra, and perhaps a little later, the Jains, and even we might include the Sikhs, that these different groups were essentially revealed, or their messages were revealed by persons who had received Hindu initiation. And that therefore these schools were indebted to the primary stream of Aryan culture for the essential principles of their doctrine. Some have gone so far, and perhaps with good reason, to infer or imply that Hinduism, or ancient Aryanism, as it was primordially taught, traces or can be traced in most of the religious systems of the now existing world. That the stream of the ancient wisdom of India flowed into Europe, flowed into North Africa, and by some mysterious route, perhaps across Asia, finally even reached the Western Hemisphere long before the advent of European colonization. But regardless of how we wish to regard these stories, the fact remains that the ancient Hindus did have secret sciences, did impose certain disciplines, did initiate their disciples into various sacred formulas, did practice natural and ceremonial magic, were concerned with the intonation of the sacred names, were conversant with the principles of sidereal motion and the essential structure of the universe, had calculated the duration of the days and nights of Brahma, and had also rather closely to our own calculations, estimated the true motions of most of the parts of the heavens. Thus, somewhere long ago, some very solid work was done. And we are all the richer for this work, although we are not too well equipped to describe the detailed circumstances. About the 6th century before the beginning of the Christian era, or very close to the time of the journey of Pythagoras to the caves of Elephanta in the harbor of Bombay, and to the Ajanta temples in the Hyderabad Deccan, a great change was being wrought in the religions and philosophies of Asia. Several great and extraordinary persons appeared, whose influence upon the cultural destiny of mankind was to be prodigious. Perhaps the most famous and universally understood of these men was Gautama Buddha, himself a Hindu, of the caste of the warriors, and bound as an initiate into the sacred religious rites of his ancestors. In Persia arose the last of the Zoroasters, Zarathustra's Pitamon. And from him came clear doctrinal indication of a strong link between the religions of Persia and the religions of India. Also at this time, there flourished in China one of the most mysterious human beings who has ever lived, and that was Lao Tzu. This mystic, this transcendental sage, this self-disciplined, self-educated, self-enlightened man was to become the greatest mystic of Asia. And even today, his solitary writing, the Tao Te Ching, in only 5,000 characters, is the most inscrutable book in the world. Yet it is interesting to note that this book has suddenly become of the greatest interest and concern to us. Whereas we have gone further in the experimentation concerning the mental life of man, we begin to recognize some of the principles that were enunciated by Lao Tzu. In this same generation also, the most formal and perhaps one of the most respected men who ever lived, the philosopher Confucius, enriched China with a magnificent ethical doctrine. Confucius made no claim to any particular mystical insight. He claimed, however, that he had a mission, a destiny. And that destiny was to bring to China a way of life suitable to a civilized human being and suitable to ensure the gradual spread of enlightenment and peace, first in China and then perhaps throughout the entire world. These men, contemporaries, left so vast an impress upon the face of Asia that they largely overshadowed the older traditions which were gradually falling into decline. Yet we cannot say that these men were spontaneous productions. They themselves originated in the tradition which preceded them. They were almost certainly in their own right initiates of the sacerdotal mysteries of their nations. They were learned in the wisdom of their people, in the wisdom of old time, and in the learning of the gods. And from their various contributions, many changes came to take place in the face of Asia. Many new doctrines and ideals were promulgated. But all in all, these were merely the long extension of the Vedic law. They were the shadow of the great original instruction and teaching imparted by Manu to his people in the mysterious northern regions of the Himavat. The mysteries, as they arose in Buddhism, are somewhat more easily understood and traceable. Gautama Buddha was essentially a reformer, but he was more than this. He was a clarifier. He took from the older doctrine those essential principles which he regarded as most necessary to the enlightenment of man. He contemplated upon the sources and causes of the decline of the Brahmanic rites. He realized that by degrees, opportunism had corrupted the priesthood of the Hindu mysteries, and that in order to defend their own rights and privileges, this priesthood had become more and more arrogant and more despotic, until for the average member of the East Indian community, there was little, if any, hope for spiritual enlightenment or even consolation of spirit. Gradually, form and ritual took over. The soul and spirit vanished, and only the letter of the law remained. And it was against this letter of the law that Gautama Buddha rebelled. The philosophy of Buddhism is therefore not to be regarded as essentially different from that of the older teachings. We know also that in his earnest desire to be of benefit to mankind, Buddha taught more publicly and perhaps more clearly than most of those who had preceded him. On the other hand, either because of his own ethical convictions or in respect for the obligations which he had previously assumed, Buddha, throughout his entire ministry, carefully avoided infringing any of the secrets or any of the esoteric doctrines essentially associated with Hinduism. In other words, he refused to take into consideration or to expound or to interpret or to elucidate those phases of Hinduism which were normally communicated under obligation. Perhaps he also felt, and this has been the general viewpoint held regarding him, that these Hindu or Brahmanic rites were either not essential to the peculiar ministry which he attempted to spread, or perhaps realizing that he was preaching in India to Hindus, that they were already well informed on these matters. There are indications in the New Testament where it would seem that Jesus followed the same procedure, not necessarily touching upon the teachings of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who were not, by the way, quite as black as they have been painted, but regarded these other teachings as the common possession of the people. Therefore, it was not necessary to comment upon them or to make public utterance concerning their meanings. In any event, Buddha obviously refused to discuss the creation of the world, the origin of the gods, or any of those peculiar yogic and Vedantic practices with which the Hindu system was so richly encrusted. Rather, to Buddha, the entire body of philosophy and wisdom was summarized in a simple formula to assist the average person to escape from the quandaries of life and to establish a career based upon intelligence, dedication, discipline, and truth. Thus, we can definitely assume that it is not proven that Buddha was, as some have affirmed, an atheist. Had he been an atheist, he could not have been an initiated Hindu. It is not at all certain that he was even an agnostic, for had he been an agnostic, the Brahmanic temples would not have accepted him, and we know that they did. Therefore, we are justified in assuming that he simply closed off the mystery pattern, except that he used it in a way which was in no way an infringement, but based upon it a system of life which he communicated in a totally different manner. The story of Buddhism, then, has to do with a modified aspect of Hinduism, in which instead of initiating disciples in ancient stone temples far beneath the earth or in the sides of hills, Buddhists initiated their disciples in a different way, perhaps to imply that all initiation is an internal experience. Therefore, the place where it is given is not as important as the fact that it is experienced inwardly by the devotee. There are, however, references in Buddhist literature to the fact that at one time in the early development of the sect, there were initiation rituals, even as there is a strong reference in several writings to the fact that initiation rituals were present in the early centuries of Christianity, although these have generally come to be ignored or forgotten. It is also very possible that what we call today the Apocalypse, or the Book of Revelation, was associated with the initiation rites, ceremonies, and dramatic presentations of the early Christians. We have reference, for example, to the fact that in a cavern of seven rooms called the Saptapanna Cave, Buddhist disciples were initiated into the mysteries of their order. Some have affirmed that this room of seven chambers was the human heart, where initiation must naturally take place. Hermes says as much to his son Tatian in regard to the Great Pyramid of Egypt, where he said that the pyramid stands modeled upon a human heart, because it is in the human heart that all the mysteries of godliness must be experienced. There are also further indications that with the rising of the Sangha, or the assembly, the church or association of Buddhism, that certain simple rites were given, certain ordinations, baptisms, confirmations were bestowed, and that as in the case of nearly all mystical or philosophical rituals or religions, there were public instructions and also other instructions given only to the disciples. And later, these secret instructions passed from Buddha to his legitimate arhats, or the great disciples of his order. And by these, in turn, other disciples were initiated into the mysteries of the doctrine. This type of teaching was based almost completely upon the guru system of the Hindus. The arhats of Buddha are the gurus of his faith. They are also the holy men, the wise ones. And never will we find a closer parallel than that between the rishis of Brahmanism and the rehats and lohans of Buddha. So the general underlying structure remains approximately the same. But in Buddhism, we have the rise of a democracy. We have the coming of something that was to change largely the thinking of the people of his time. And his concept of education and the principles upon which his philosophy was built finally integrated into the formation of the great University of Nalanda in central India, where the instruction which had once privately been given in the Brahmin sanctuaries or had been communicated under obligation in the valley of the Euphrates, this instruction was made available in another way. At Nalanda, which is perhaps the largest university the world has ever known, entrance was for those who desired to learn. No longer was initiation or acceptance into this institution dependent upon blood or family or caste or even creed. The great requirement was a devout determination to improve oneself. Therefore, from all over Asia, students seeking knowledge visited the wonderful community college or university, which was famous for centuries for its great lotus pools, in which blue lotus flowers blossomed, it is said, throughout the year. The University of Nalanda is mentioned by a few early travelers and writers before its final decline and disappearance. These say that in this university there was a faculty of over 1,500 or 2,000 instructors, that the student body frequently numbered above 25,000 at a single time, and perhaps more, and that the university and its buildings and its student body occupied a complete city, and that here there were towers for the study of the stars, great laboratories for research into nature. Here art and medicine and law were studied, and here, we are told, Christianity was taught as part of comparative religion. The University of Nalanda, therefore, was much like the temple schools of Egypt and Greece. But instead of the candidate becoming initiated by oath and obligation, Buddhism simply opened the door and said, "Brother, do you wish to know? If you do, come and learn with us." This was therefore perhaps Buddha's greatest departure. He felt that it was no longer right that knowledge be held into the narrow bonds of class and caste, that all men were created with the inalienable right to know. But it is further true that most of those who attended this great college finally did take holy orders, becoming themselves monks and mystics. But we also know that in this same university, the transcendental arts were taught. And here, the Buddhist equivalent to the most secret arts of yoga and Vedanta were communicated. But they were communicated again in a different way, not with the ceremonial magic of ancient Hinduism, but now as forms of discipline, in which the individual imposed certain duties upon himself, in which the individual followed the original instruction given by Buddha in his last great service or sermon, as recorded in the Book of the Great Deceased, where he turned to his assembled disciples and said to them, "My brethren, be an island unto yourselves. Be a refuge unto yourselves. Work out your own salvation with diligence." This was the summary and substance of Buddhism, that it offered no magic, but that it provided the individual with a wonderful power to be his own magician, and that by certain meditations, disciplines, by the control and directing of habit and character, by continual abstinence from those corruptions which turn the mind from the contemplation of reality to engrossment in illusion, the Buddhist gradually obtained those internal powers which had previously been regarded as the magic of Hinduism. We know also that the struggle between Buddha and the Brahmins ended finally in the defeat of Buddhism in India. Little by little, the Brahmanic caste, the Brahmanic religion, the ancient religion of the land, encroached upon the achievements of Buddhism. Little by little, the Brahmins regained their ancient authority. And in the end, Buddhism retired to other nations and left India to its Hinduism, which in turn finally received a terrible blow with the rise of Muslim power in India. And during this rise, both the Buddhist and Brahmin monuments were mutilated or destroyed. And the temporal power of Hinduism was broken so far as India is concerned. By that time, however, most of Buddhism had departed from the land and had found haven in other and more congenial regions. Among the early arhats of Buddhism, there are many who have been variously attributed with magical powers, and practically every attribute of the ancient Egyptian, Greek initiate is to be recorded of these Buddhist arhats. They had the miraculous powers of invisibility. They could communicate themselves, they could communicate with others at a distance. They could precipitate themselves invisibly through space. And one of them, like our dear old friend Daruma, or Bodhidharma, patriarch of Zen, is said to have sailed across the China Sea on a millet stalk. These were the magics of Buddhism. But this magic is deep in the old concept of esotericism. And in the course of time, this esotericism burst forth again. It was declared that in his sermon on the Vulture's Peak, Buddha had communicated esoterically to one of his disciples the secret of universal meditation. On this occasion, therefore, there was created a secret school. And in this secret school, not only were human beings, but also creatures of the invisible regions, instructed in the mysteries of the doctrine of salvation. After the passing of Buddha, a number of years and even a few centuries elapsed. But gradually, the esoteric side of Buddhism broke through again. And that which had long been an austere philosophy now began to take on its religious complexion. So we find the second stage of Buddhism, as we suggested at the beginning, the gradual drift from a philosophy to an advanced mysticism. This advanced mysticism arose at about the beginning of the Christian era. It is a little difficult to tell just when, but this is a very interesting and vital point, and sometimes a great deal may hinge upon the clarification. Up to now, however, the documents and records are not available. But it is, of course, possible that, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, material relating to this critical time will ultimately be recovered. It was generally assumed that esoteric Buddhism had its great revival in the first century A.D., and that in some way or method there was a connection between the Mahayana school of Buddhistic mysticism and the rising school of Christianity in the Near East. The physical contact was possible, there is no doubt, for it has already been demonstrated that the Silk Routes were open, that caravans coming from China, India, Siam, then Siam, and Cambodia did reach southern Europe, and that even at the time of the Roman Empire, the Romans were wearing silk woven in China. Now, this means that contact is quite possible, but the certainties we do not have. More recent studies, however, are inclined to push back the date of the rise of the Mahayana sect to probably the first century B.C. If such is the case, then we have an entirely different story, but we cannot be dogmatic on this subject now. In any event, Nagarjuna found in the Iron Tower the secret books of Mahayana. It was from this structure, therefore, that a great Buddhist mysticism arose, known as the Northern School, or the School of High Buddhism, a school which reached its greatest ecclesiastical apex in the rising of Lamaism in Tibet and the establishment of the hierarchies of the Dalai Lama and the Panchen Lama. Here was High Buddhism, with its high mass, with all of its rites and rituals, with its saints' days and holy deeds, with everything that had to do with an involved ecclesiasticism. And not far from Lhasa itself, perched upon a nearby peak, the great magical medical monastery of Tsongkhapa, where the deepest mysteries of magic and sorcery, where the ancient teachings of the Kala Chakra and the Tantra, where yoga and all of the mysteries relating to breath, meditation, and mantra were taught and continued to be taught until the recent Russian invasion. So we have in this instance one phase of our Mahayana, and the fact that certainly initiation into Lamaism in Tibet was for centuries a most profound and elaborate ritual, divided into several degrees, with candidates advancing step by step from the more profane subjects to those that dealt entirely with sacred matters. In all of these groups, from the Hindu down through Buddhism, among the more advanced studies were those which involved the scriptures of the people. And in many areas, even today, learned Hindus or Buddhists can recite volumes almost as long as the entire Bible from memory. Great study and studentship in these specialized areas. The rise of Mahayana brought with it a kind of Eastern Gnosticism. There was a wonderful multiplication of hierarchy. The invisible worlds began to take precedence over all visible matters. The strange austerity of the Nibbana gave way to Amitabha's blessed land. And there is no doubt in the world that a large part of this ritualism and symbolism was actually ritualistic. In the Field Museum in Chicago, there is a large group of costumes and masks used by Tibetan people and those of surrounding areas such as Mongolia, Bhutan, and Nepal, for the presentation of sacred dramas. Here we will see, for example, the entire paradise of Amitabha, provided for by exact costumes and masks to be worn by actors, were therefore undoubtedly presented this spectacle, much as the Egyptians performed their mysterious rituals of the dead in the crypts beneath the temples of Luxor and Karnak. Thus, in the northern schools, certainly in Tibet and several other areas, there is no doubt that the rituals described in the Buddhist sutras were actually performed, that candidates were actually conducted through the mysteries of the eight worlds, that disciples seeking initiation experienced the 12 nidanas, and probably in the end came face to face with the mirror of righteousness in which they could perceive in the dark and mysterious depths of what obsidian lens all of the mysterious happenings of their own previous lives. It was an involved system of ritualism, but it certainly existed. And there is much material in connection with this subject to be found in the Field Museum in Chicago and in a publication which they have issued, a pamphlet, dealing with the magical and mystery plays of Tibet. In other parts of Asia, Mahayana also took over in a very powerful way. I do think, however, that in most of these other regions, the gentle mystery of Buddhism became more and more entirely personal. And one of the teachings, even of Mahayana, was that the entire initiation rite should be accepted into the self as a phase of consciousness. It was not by seeing actors performing their rituals, or even by magical means causing invisible spirits to appear and to produce various effects upon the beholders. These were not the ways of wisdom in Buddhism. Their way was that the individual in quietude should contemplate upon the mysteries of the law, and following the essential teachings of the Tathagata, should gradually come to know, to experience inwardly, to be released gradually from the pressure of worldly conditions, until finally they could rest in peace, in quiet communion with their own inner lives, to be instructed by the golden Buddha that was enshrined forever in their own hearts. This was their essential teaching, but we cannot say that this teaching was never modified or never subject to any changes or specializations. We realize also that as Buddhism passed from one nation to another, it mingled itself very much with the local beliefs and traditions of the people, so that Buddhism became a series of admixtures. It was never the practice or habit of Buddhism to attempt the extermination of another religion, nor did it ever persecute the followers of other faiths. Rather, it settled beside them and gradually absorbed them into its own structure, or finally acknowledged that, after all, both groups were worshipping the same principles under other names. This tolerance led to a very favorable relationship between Buddhism and most of the nations where its missionaries visited. We know also that among the great initiate adepts, as they were called, who are associated with the University of Nalanda, two names stand out as being of particular interest to us. One, of course, was the Blessed Guru, who brought the doctrines of Buddhism to Tibet, carrying the books across the great mountain passes, or driving oxen laden with sacred material over the mountains into the forbidding land above the snow.